Hi, welcome back to the Mod Mentality Show. I'm Chris Lucian, and my co-host is Austin Chadwick. And today we're joined by Ron Cortell, and we're going to be talking a little bit about dynamic remobbing, mob self-selection, and mobbing at scale. So, Ron, why don't you start by kind of giving us an introduction to yourself, and then we can get into our topics.
So, yeah, I am Ron Cortell. We haven't met, so let's see. Is this what? Yeah. I'm a developer at heart. I'm still a developer. I that was the start of my career, and I just can't get away from it. If I do, I get itchy enough to get back to the code. I'm XP coach. They usually call it a technical coach these days. I've been an agile coach. I've been a dev manager and other stuff. But you'll hear me say my life's purpose is to untether the human spirit in the workplace. And I'm hoping that will come through today. But when I grow up, I want to be Woody Zorn.
Don't we all?
I know, right? Yeah. The guy is truly my hero. And I try to emulate Woody in so many ways. So before I go into the topic of mobbing at scale, I wanted to get an idea about mobbing where you are. How many mobs do you have now?
We are somewhere in between 7 and 8 mobs. So about 27 people when we have interns, sometimes we go up to 34 or so, in the group.
And are any of the mobs working on the same or dependent products?
Yeah. So we have a tri mob, or maybe a 3 mob product, a 2 mob product, and 2 other 1 mob products. And then we grow or shrink by 2 mobs from time to time.
Okay. That's cool. I like the sound of that. Another question is, what's the dev manager to developer ratio where you are now?
So there are 4, I guess, managers. Before we were flat, and then we recently introduced kind of a little bit of a hierarchy. It's essentially flat, but the answer to that question would be about 4 for that group. So maybe 5 to 1 or so.
And one thing I'll add is the people in that role, the day-to-day practice no different. They're just a mobber on a team.
Yeah. Being a manager on the team it means that you're operating in a flat system.
Yeah. And the people you're on your team may or may not be in part of your hierarchy or whatever. So it's kind of a business as usual sort of thing.
And is the mobs, are they static?
Not at all. Yeah. So anytime you want, you can move to a different mob. The maximum you're allowed to stay on any one mob is up to 2 years in the last 3 years. Any product, really. You can't stay on the same product that long. But in practice, the products that have multiple mobs, they rotate members or randomize members of each mob every week.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
All right. This is good. This is I want to talk about a couple of years I spent at a large, medium to large health insurance company here in the Pacific Northwest. I live in Seattle, and it's an experiment that we ran. And it sounds there's a lot of similarity to what you're doing. While we were working on this experiment, this book came up, this Team of Teams. Are you familiar with Team of Teams?
I have not read it.
Okay. No, I'm not familiar. Yeah.
Okay. So in Team of Teams, General Stanley McChrystal, he comes up with this concept of command of teams, which is essentially what the military was. Or a command structure, and then he talks about this command of teams, and we see this a lot in probably most agile places because it's team based, very team based. But if you have these static teams, it becomes a command of teams. This is where I was kind of questioning about, hey, what's the manager to developer ratio? So you can end up with this like command of teams approach. And so what I'm going to talk about today is a team of teams approach, where we go into this fluid structure. It's a lot more latticed. I've got a couple of examples there of Gore and Valve, very famous examples of this structure, which we found out we were actually mimicking. We learned about the book afterwards. So between 2016 and 18, while we were working together and really kind of coming up with our own process, Woody came out to talk to us about mob programming. And that had a huge impact on us. So for the people on the podcast, I'm just showing a couple of pictures of what it looked like. Here's one of our mobs. There's three people. Here's another mob. So we kind of took to it like a duck to water. It was instantly popular. So the current slide I'm showing is of Woody giving his presentation. You guys will have seen this. Mob programming, all the brilliant minds working on the same thing at the same time in the same space. That's an awesome concept, and it relates really well at the team level. But what if there was 150 brilliant minds that needed to work on the same thing at the same time in the same space? How would this scale? Is the kind of question. Well, so how would we have the right mobs working on the right work at the right time is essentially the question. Like, I got 150 people and we want to do mob programming. And those words, they sounded to me a lot like open space. So I know you're both familiar with open space, right?
Yeah.
The open space is five principles and one law. So for people on the podcast aren't familiar, whoever comes are the right people. Whatever happens is the only thing that could have happened. When it starts is the right time, where it starts is the right place. When it's over, are the five principles. And so those questions we were asking about, well, how do we get the right mobs working on the right thing? I'm like, open space. So open space plays quite large in this story. And the final part is the law of mobility. It used to be called the law of 2 feet. Is a common way of remembering it. If you find yourself in a situation where you're not contributing or learning, move somewhere where you can. And so this became true of our mobs. Like, if I'm in a mob, I'm like, I can go and just dynamically join another team. I say mob and team and swarm interactively. So we call them swarms, but nine times out of 10, the swarm was a mob.
Working that way all the time rather than only in special situations. I think that's the distinction in my mind between mob and swarm, right?
Yes, yeah, and it was optional. It was not optional to not work in a team, you had to be part of a team. So all work had to be collaborative, but it was optional how you worked and everyone always picked mobbing. Like once we did the mobbing training, that was it. So what we did essentially was we combined open space with open allocation. So open allocation, I'm showing a slide for the people on the podcast that shows what closed allocation looks like versus open allocation. And in the closed allocation, it's got this idea of a vision, which breaks down into initiatives, which breaks down into projects, which breaks down into tasks. And we're very familiar with this in the Agile world, like a feature is an epic story, task, blah, right? And yep. It's very like this reductionist mindset, reductionism. And what if we didn't do that? What if we went to this idea of open allocation? And that word comes from, are you familiar with Gore and Valve?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think when scaling our department from one mob to seven, I think I might have gone through a very similar mental journey as what it looks like you have here. So Gore-Tex and Valve were used primarily as two major models in the system that we developed to scale. I wrote a scaling mob programming article for the Big Agile conference, and so there's some material there that's out there as well. Yeah,
I have not read that. I'm kind of curious to see how much we have in common.
Yeah. I just from what you've said so far, I think a whole lot.
Yeah.
Well, it's fascinating to me here observing the two, like independently, kind of, you know, triangulating on the same thing. But please continue, Ron. I'm fascinated to see what you're thinking next year.
Okay. Valve, I'd like to point out, because they're here in Seattle. I actually got to go do a tour of the offices there.
Nice.
I was you know, like a kid in a candy store. I'm like, this is amazing. And I don't know how many people realize this, that. In 2012, Valve were employing around 250 people, and they were worth over $3 billion. So I don't know if I know they're a private company, so I don't know if we've got more modern numbers, but this is one that I found. 2012, 250 people, $3 billion, which made them the most profitable company per employee in the United States of America, which is incredible. And for 250 people and zero managers. I like to put that out because that's going to come back in the story.
Yep.
So if you look at that image of open allocation, you're like, well, that looks like chaos. And I realized after, it is chaos. But the word chaos is misunderstood, because I started studying chaos theory. I see Chris nodding his head. So I'm hoping, I think I'm speaking quiet here. You know, so chaos and complexity, that they're tightly related, but there's a lot of beauty in chaos, right? Emergence, simple rules, self-organizing systems, complex adaptive systems, natural order from chaos, and novelty, discovery, innovation. Novelty discovery comes from, you want to be in a chaotic environment. So there's this idea of, like, how do we dip into chaos long enough to come out? So one of the books there I've highlighted is Surfing on the Edge of Chaos, and that's the concept here. How do we stay in this complex adaptive system, but then dip into chaos when we need? And that became apparent from Open Space, because when you say, if you've been to Open Space conference and they say go, you're essentially opening the room up to chaos. And people that have never been to an Open Space conference, you describe it and you're like, and they'll say, that sounds like chaos. And it is chaos. But chaos isn't a bad word. So now I've come to learn that when people say chaos, they mean disorganization. So I always correct them. I'm like, you mean disorganized, because once you understand chaos theory, chaos, there is actually a pattern underlying it. And there are simple rules underneath it all. In fact, so I'm writing a book. I'm wondering if I should call it Dr. Stranger Tractor, How I Learned to Command and Control and Love Chaos. Nice. The fact you're laughing, it means you've seen the movie and you understand something about chaos theory.
So we
combined open space with open allocation. So what does that look like? Well, we got all the teams and we put them in together into a tribe. So let's say you had at our largest we were about 50 people. So we had 50 people in one tribe. We throw the work on the wall. And this is kind of based off story mapping. And then we hold an open space like event for people to self-organize into teams. 2 days later, we come back together and sync up with a quick show and tell of what each team did. And then we hold an open space like event for people to self-organize into teams. And then 2 days later, we come back and sync up, show what we did, and hold an open space like, okay, so it's, That's the sequence of events. So essentially, you pick which team you want to go on. I'll give an example. I might describe it better. So all the work is on the wall, and before the meeting starts, the product director will come up and say, yeah, "You guys are amazing." Product director is like Jeff General Patton sending troops out to war. Like, "You guys are amazing." This is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. This is why we're doing it. This is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. Like that repetition. And here's a new feature that's come up, right? And because if we can get this done, we've got Microsoft coming in a month. If we can get this new feature done, I think we've got a really good chance of winning them as a customer. And this is going up on our story wall, story map wall here as a new feature. Okay, go. So when product director says go, these 50 people look at the wall, and then someone will get up and say, well, I've been working on the blah, blah, blah feature, and I want to continue that. I'm going to be over in room number 2. So you can see the similarity to open space here. Someone else will get up and say, well, yeah, I actually finished the feature XYZ, but I've left a whole bunch of tech debt behind. I'm going to be doing refactoring and tidy up. I'm going to be over in room 3. Someone else says, well, I really like the sound of that new feature. I'm going to pick that up. I'm going to be over in room 4. So I've given 4 examples here, of which 2 actually came off the wall and 2 didn't. And that's okay, because I trust the tribe to do the right thing. You say you got to do refactoring, go do refactoring. You know what needs to happen. Someone else will get up and say, well, you know, I'm noticing there's a common theme coming through. I think we need this component layer. I'm going to be working on architecture. I'm going to be over in room number 5. So again, nothing off the wall, but I trust the tribe. I trust you to do the right thing. So there, we've now got 5 people that said they're going to be doing things. The rest of the tribe, look at that. So just like open space, and you're looking at the we call it the iteration board, but it's not even iterative. We look at the iteration board and you go, well, all right, I'm you know, Davith is such an awesome coder. Like his code craft skills are amazing, and he's facilitating the room 2. I'm going to go to room 2 because I want to work with Davith, and that's why I went to Davith. Someone else might go, yeah, I've been working on the back end for so long. I really want to do something front endy. Okay, room 3's got some good front end stuff. I'm going to go to room 3. But what happens most of the time is, remember someone said, well, I'm working on this feature. I'm going to keep going with it. That's what happens most of the time. And people will become sticky teams, and because they take ownership, right? So they will take ownership and they go to the room and they continue on. But essentially, every time we do it, you've got the opportunity for switching teams, for forming new teams. And we form teams. We use the tribal knowledge, collective intelligence, to decide, hey, what's the most important thing we should be working on right now?
Yeah. So this sounds very similar to us. And I think, you know, more recently, so maybe say half a year ago to a year ago, you know, we did have the sticky teams. Like we definitely had mobs that would become very sticky. And so the team, the multi-mob products, both essentially independently decided that having regular randomizations and only staying on a team if absolutely necessary was kind of a thing. And so it actually became a very good practice for us, because you know, now it's oh, I need to stay on this because I have the most context and I really want to share that with whoever joins, and so we're going to move that forward. And it's like, okay, well, does anybody else on the team need to stay on the team? Oh, well, no. Okay, now we're going to just shuffle everyone. And if you end up on the same team again, fine. And if you don't, then that's okay too. And so right now, all 5 to 6 of those mobs are regularly swapping out people as a priority over staying. Mm-hmm. And that's to reduce silos of knowledge and things like that. So it's ended up being a really good practice.
Yeah. Oh, wow. There's so much commonality here.
Yeah.
So there's one meeting, we called it the fast meeting, and it took about 15 minutes. And we did this every 2 days. So initially we called it a 2-day iteration, but then it's not an iteration because that meeting when we get back together and we do what we call show and tell. So when, if you've got 50 people, right, and we got 5 teams coming together, I want everything to be quick. So it's show and tell. If if my team was doing, we were fixing the format, the log format, at show and tell, I'm not going to give a demo. Look, here we can see this state format is now in the system. Right? I'm not going to do that to people. So you get up and you say, yeah, we did it. We were working on the day format thing. That's done. And that's all you got to say. So you really, it's closer to a stand-up. If you've got a demo and it makes sense, then give a demo. But you're not there to get sign-off. You're not showing it to a product owner. You're keeping the entire tribe in sync. That's the whole purpose of the show and tell. So we're all back in sync. And so we could get through this in 15 minutes. And that was the one meeting. And we were doing this every 2 days. We went to a week for a while, and then everyone went, oh, you know what, we prefer 2 days. It felt like we're making more progress. We switched back to 2 days as this check-in point. So one of the, I'm showing an image here of the early days, and on the back wall, you can see, remember I said we were using story mapping? So this idea of like throwing the work on the wall. So story mapping was the idea. I'm protecting the innocent here in the photos. So anyone that's blurred out, I haven't had to pass intermission yet. No, I'm working on that. We started out with story mapping, but we found pretty quickly that like as the tribe got larger, it's really hard to maintain that story map because it splintered quicker than we could kind of maintain it. I don't know if you're experimenting with story mapping at all, but we ended up switching to this idea of a release. We called it the release map. In the one I'm showing now, everything above that orange line is not in this release. We go, yeah, that's an important feature. I can't forget it. Above the line. Everything below the line was kind of in the release. But the release map only represented the features. And in this one, you can see aspect as well, like the security. So if there's something in there, but essentially it's feature level is big. And we didn't put stories on here. We just kept the features on here. So this was where a product director could look at, hey, what's going on? You know, what's been started, what's left, and what's going on? And you can see some of the post-it notes there towards the bottom, they got lines through them. That's because they're completed. So we had a way of indicating started and completed. And that was one of the things that we had like a couple of really neat discoveries. And one of them was release mapping and feature mapping.
Mm-hmm.
Where we broke story mapping down into something a little finer grain.
This has a lot of similarities to something that I think Austin uses a lot, which is maybe the graphical Kanban and above the line, below the line, sort of before release, after release. It looks very similar to a digital format that we have, actually.
Yep. And actually, it is very similar to what we're doing now on like a virtual drawing tool diagram. But I also remember seeing these on the wall. In the mob building.
There was definitely, I think there was experimentation with story maps. And so I would say, you know, no one's required to use any one tool. And so what typically happens is some teams are just using pure Kanban. Some are using a system like this one. You know, some had been using story maps. I think that's kind of died out recently in favor of Kanban, but it kind of fluctuates fairly often depending on the context and the need.
I love that the teams aren't proud to use whatever they want. That's awesome. You know, if you treat people like adults and give them autonomy, then hey, we want to do this. Like, okay, as long as you get the work done, I don't care what you use. You know?
Yeah, and I think I'll jump in there and say that's one thing I admire about the model you're sharing, Ron, and then the one Chris and I are familiar with is that choice is huge, right? In that autonomy to be, hey, I want to switch around. I want to, you know, kind of be an open space. What's it called? The bumblebee.
Yeah.
Or it's like, hey, I've really got invested in this work and I'm going to stick on this team for a while, you know? And I think I love that it allows for both to occur. So
I want to ask you the same questions that you asked earlier. Do you have managers that did did they have to adjust to this system? Anything along those lines? Did you eliminate all the managers?
So when we started, because we didn't start with 50 people. We actually started small. And well, here's how the story started. We started out as an XP team. And we said from the beginning, right, extreme programming is really important, all the practices. So we started out as an XP team and on one product. I actually joined as a developer. And they were going to hire a Scrum Master. And I said, hey, can I be a part of, helping recruit the Scrum Master? Because if we get that wrong, I've been in part of the team. If you get that wrong, it's not good. And my manager says, sure, we'll help. So I ended up filling in for Scrum Master while we're looking. So I became dev manager to Scrum Master. And then we were expanding the team because we were going to take on a second product. So the team is now getting larger and larger. I think we're probably about 16 people. And XP can maintain 16 people. It's doable. Yeah. It's a juggle, but you can because of pair programming and the communication. So we had about 16, and we knew taking on another product. So now the next product was landing. The next product was sexy. The original product was already becoming a product. It was not great, right? And we were hiring people that had special skills for this next product, which was mostly mobile related. So now the question was, so at this point, I'm now like agile coach because I found someone else to come in and help with Scrum Master. So I went from dev to Scrum Master, agile coach within 6 months. And then the question was, well, all right, we're now about to start this second product. What do we do? And so there's a standard Scrum answer to that. Well, you split the teams. Well, then it's like, well, how do we split the teams? Because is it fair that the people that have been working here the longest, they're the ones that probably most deserve to go over to the new product, but then they're locked into the old product because they know so much about it, right? Because if we have, so there's this whole dilemma. And that was when the idea of open space came back to me. And I said, hey, do you want to run an experiment? Why don't we, for 2 months, try and stay as one tribe, work on both products, and as long as all the work gets done, it doesn't matter. We'll have this marketplace of work, and let's see how it goes. And that was how the whole experiment started. So at that point, there was one manager. Later on, we ended up with two managers. So by the time, probably about 40 people, we had two managers. And then after that, there was another round of management that came in. We were at a ratio of 1 to 8, and that caused issues. And it was part of the downfall of this experiment, unfortunately. And I can share a bit more of that at the end, because this concept of autonomy mastering purpose needs to be consistent throughout, throughout the tribe.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you don't have that, particularly at the management level, things start to fall apart.
Was that there was less autonomy because the number of managers was increasing, or was it the opposite direction? Like, what would you say?
So we had, so I'm in a very traditional organization, extremely traditional. And we had a CTO who, he was new and he gave us autonomy. So we used that autonomy. And when I joined, I hated this company, right? My friend's like, hey, friend Steve's like, hey, you need to come work here. I'm like, why would I ever want to work there? Because I've been consulting there with Lauren. Like, this is such a backward point. I don't even want to work there. Because no, this time's different. We get to do XP, we've got autonomy, and it's going to be a skunk works. It's going to be run like a startup. So I interviewed the manager. I'm like, if you can convince me this is true, I'll come work with you. And so he did. He convinced me, and that's how I ended up working there. Nice. But when we lost that autonomy, so the CTO ended up leaving. We lost that autonomy, and that was the beginning of the end. And so the corporate culture of command and control just came crushing in. Plus, we had some internal issues, which I can talk about as well. But it was a combination of like 3 or 4 things, which brought the whole thing down, which made me really sad because it was. With this camel, it was all wonderful. Yeah.
Okay. So the, I guess in short, a little bit of, making things a little bit more command and control really disrupted all the kind of good things that might have been going on.
Yeah.
I get that for sure.
So, on that line, let me just, I've got loads of pictures here, which we don't need to go to. There's some pictures of the boards and how we used to stand with our meetings. This is when we're at our largest, is about 50 people. I've got the theoretical maximum size of 150, which is Dunbar's number.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Did we do an episode on Dunbar's number? We might not have done it yet, but
not yet.
That's on our backlog because I was looking at all the Dunbar stuff, saying, I mean, the exact same train of thought. It's just fascinating. How high can it go? And mm-hmm. I think that Gore-Tex in writings about Gore-Tex. Yes. They talk a lot about Dunbar's number and when they decide to split the company into two effective chunks of the company. Mm-hmm. And so Gore-Tex I found very fascinating when researching them back then.
Mm-hmm.
Super cool.
Yeah, that played a big part in this concept. Like, because I think that's probably the top limit of where you want to go. We used it. This is actually, there's three mobs there. This was a hackathon. So yeah, this format actually works really well and it's very similar to a hackathon where, you know, you have a bunch of people that don't know each other. They come together for a weekend and in 2 days they produce work and software and they get up and they present it. That's exactly what we were doing. And so this idea of like, hey, people that don't know each other is storming, norming, performing. It's not true, because otherwise hackathons would never work, right? We've got people that don't know each other can come together. They're joined by a common vision, like, hey, yeah, I want to work on that thing. You want to work on that? Hey, let's work together. And then they get stuff done. So hackathons disprove Tuckman's development model. And in fact, you can Google Tuckman was wrong. I think Doc Norton did research there.
So self-organization, I think, you know, if Tuckman's model does exist, then it short circuits it quite a bit, right? Mm-hmm. But as soon, you know, I feel like as soon as you get strong egos bumping up against each other, then those sorts of things come out. But if everybody's passionate about the same thing and are willing to collaborate and have the skills necessary to interact well with each other, which usually I think people that attend hackathons do end up joining like that, then you find some really awesome stuff can happen for sure.
And that's the concept. Hire people that are team players that aren't gigantic egos, right? And just let them work together. And you're right, because if the difference between a team and a group is, you know, a team is some people that are bonded together. Now, in our organizations, we have groups and we're forcing these groups into teams. Yeah, they're going to go through Tuckman's model, but if you can self-select into a team, hey, let's bypass all of that nonsense, right? So, that's the model. We had, the aspects here. We had no story points, no estimates, no stories, no acceptance criteria, no definitions done, no scrum masters, no iterations, no velocity, no grooming. So it's a very different agile, like when you, it's the bombs out there from crew. Yeah, like, you know, all of this stuff has become stuff, right? And you really start questioning it. And it became a very lightweight process, which sounds weird because we had a team of, you know, a tribe of 50 people self-organizing every 2 days. We didn't need all this stuff. We just, it just worked. I mentioned feature mapping. So this is a topic all in itself. And I need to do a write-up and talk about it. But essentially that node at the top there is the feature. And you remember the example I said when one of the stories was, hey, we've got this feature, we can get this done. So if I walk into the room with that feature, let's say there's 6 months worth of work in there. I'm now in a room with four other people that have showed up and I've got a feature of 6 months of work. We're in a 2 day iteration. It's not really an iteration, but we're in a time box of 2 days. And the question is, what are you going to do? well, you're not going to finish the feature. Well, what do? Well, what's the first thing you do with something big? You break it down. So we'll get the product director or SME or whoever in the room. We'll say, hey, tell me about this feature. And they say, well, it's blah, 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 blah. So I say, okay, blah, 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 blah. They sound like four chunks of work. Is that right? Yeah. So in this example here, that one node breaks down into four. There's the four things. So we look at those four and we go, all right, of those four, we'd probably start on that one. Tell us about that one. And he'll say, well, that's flimflam flow. So I break, okay, that's flimflam flow. So I don't want to use the word story or epic because it's a chunk, right?
Yeah.
Agile developers know how to break work down. So we go, okay, that's that. All right, of those three, where would we start? Well, we'll probably start on that one. Well, tell us about that. And so we keep going down until we know we're working on the right thing. We go, okay, now we've got work that we can do where there's like a day and a half left. There we go. And then, so we keep this, we break down work just enough, just in time. And now we've got our work. And so this was one of the big, big discoveries we had, feature mapping and breaking down work just enough, just in time. And we kept this because if you had dynamic teams, so now I've got the context. If I look at this wall, this feature map, I can see exactly what's been done, what hasn't been done. As things get done, you actually like tear them off. So it's like this accordion that kind of moves and grows. But I can instantly see, hey, where we're at and kind of what's left. And the concept of when we're going to be done, because I can say, all right, we've been working on this for a month. We've got two of the top four done. So it's probably another month left, right? So we never did any estimating.
Your product director probably did estimate though, based on what they saw on the wall, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, last week's weather is on the wall, quite literally.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was one of the big discoveries. The other question that comes up a lot is dependencies. And so if I walk into room A and we say, all right, hey, what are we going to do? We talk about it. And we say, hey, I think we're going to clash with team B. So before we do any work, hey, let's go over to work in team B. Hey, team B, what are you guys thinking? Or are you people thinking? Because we're going to clash. All right, let's have an architectural discussion. We're thinking of this. Yeah, that makes sense. All right, let's take some photos of that, stick it on the wiki. So we're doing just enough architecture, just in time. And you know what? It doesn't make sense for two teams to be working on this. All right, we'll go pick up something else for the wall. You guys do that. It's just that simple. So we allow emergence to come forward. Like dependencies, or we might say, oh, well, let's merge into one tribe or one team. Or we might say, okay, yeah, well, I'll do this bit. You guys do that bit. Yeah, that works too. So just this constant communication. That was how we resolved.
Yeah. And I think I'll jump in here for a little bit on those last two points, because I think it's, again, one of those like, hey, we're kind of doing the same thing slightly differently. Yeah. So on the, what you just said, where teams can just go talk to each other and figure out dependencies, that's exactly how it works. Like there's no like formal process for that to happen, right? If there's a clash, we just go talk and figure it out. And then, humans are good at figuring that kind of thing out. And mm-hmm. I love the feature mapping here thing too, because some of our mobs have done this kind of thing. We've been calling it more like graphic Kanban, but what's amazing about it is it enables context, right? You have context on whatever you were working on, right? Yeah. And so even if different people come along, they can see like, oh, you have gotten these pieces done and we're going to work on this thing next. And you can see kind of how things have broken down. And maybe we need to do an episode on that, Chris, graphic Kanban to show at least another way of doing it than he's showing here. But it's fantastic for the team, for context on what we're doing and what the status is. And then also, as you've seen, for the stakeholders, they have the living diagram. So for us, it's virtual now. But in this example, they could just go look at the wall and see how things are going and how many cards are left and et cetera.
Yeah. And the slide I've just shown pulled up is at this show and tell, quite often, we've got a team member here, they'll just slide in. So this whiteboard, which was the feature map, because you can quickly point at it, you go, well, here's what we got done, here's where we're going. And anyone can quickly look at that and go, okay. So it became really good, as you said, the context, and a communication piece. One, because you mentioned estimating forecasting, we actually started playing with Wisdom of Crowds forecasting too. So I won't go into it because we're coming towards the end here, but that was a pretty fascinating little experiment here where we said, hey, so rather than this idea of, you know, determinism and reductionism where, hey, we can only work out how big things are by breaking it down to the nth degree, we said, well, let's just say, hey, this feature here, how big is it? And we just asked the entire tribe, we've got their guess, and we averaged it, and there we go, and we've now got a size. So I could forecast an entire backlog in minutes. Is it correct? It's just as correct as every other dumb forecasting method, right? So we came up with a method, we actually did some experimentation around it as well. We're counting jelly beans. I don't know if you've ever done the jelly bean count. Try this. So before we did it, I actually ran the jelly bean experiment from Wisdom of Crowds, where we said, hey, how many jelly beans in this jar? Yeah. If you do it, I don't know if I should tell you. Yeah. Well, the typical response is it'll come in within 5% accuracy. And so I wanted to test it. And sure enough, it comes in with 5% accuracy. It's kind of creepy. Like, wow, how did that work? And so we said, all right, it seems to work. So that's, we tried to use that as a forecasting mechanism.
Yep.
Yeah. Cool. But essentially that's the, that was the idea. We kind of merged all of these ideas together. Reinventing Organizations. Are you guys familiar with that book? It introduces the idea of a new type of organization, which Valve and Gore are really the kind of leaders in teal. So teal is up here on the right. I think agile is here is green. And I think teal is the next level. I like to say teal is the new agile. Mm-hmm. And this is where we have the decentralized network, self-management, which is why I was asking about managers. And yeah. I don't think we need managers if we do this right.
Yeah.
What's a manager going to manage? So the work needs to still happen, but it doesn't need to be done by a manager.
So even during this conversation, I wrote a note to myself for an episode that I want to record, which would be minimum viable management. And so if you're in an organization where management is inevitable, mm-hmm. then what is the minimum viable look like, and what do you do? Because I think we've been working through this recently, and so I think I have a lot of new opinions on this, on if a essentially flat organization has to take on managers, what does it look like to preserve flatness in a organization with managers? So I think that would be a very interesting conversation. Maybe we can have that on another episode.
So I'm not against hierarchy, but I'm against managers. And management. Sure. People don't need managing. Systems do.
Okay. Great quote, I like that.
There's a great quote from Peter Drucker, right? Because we're now in the knowledge working age, and knowledge workers don't need management. They need autonomy.
Yeah.
And we are very much in the knowledge working field. So in self-organizing systems, you actually do end up with a hierarchy, but it's a natural hierarchy. So if I get up, if I stand up and say, hey, I'm gonna lead a team, this is natural hierarchy, natural leadership. Yeah. And that's good and natural. And so I might be a leader for a month, 2 months, and then I'm no longer be a leader because I've moved to something else. So it was a very fluid structure and fluid. So this word fluid keeps coming up. But once you form these lattice organizations, you get fluid leadership as well.
Fantastic.
Yeah, which is very different to management and static management. So, and leadership and management are two very different words.
I think we should do an episode on this. I think we should make a follow-up. We should make a follow-up.
All right. Well, you know I'm really passionate on this subject. Yeah, I do.
All right. Yeah. So to all of our listeners and viewers, thank you for tuning in. If you think that this episode will help anybody that you might think is interested in similar topics, please share this with them. I think sharing the podcast helps a lot. And thank you very much for watching. Subscribe, like, and we will see you all later. Bye, everybody.
Bye.